Welcome to Dad's on the Air for the 19th of June 2007. Got an interesting show coming up. Our researcher Greg Anderson has done some excellent work interviewing experts on new dads. We're going a little bit early today because we're trying to clear a backlog of material. Dad's on the Air is going through a golden era, producing some of the best shows it's ever done in the 7 years that it's been running. We are now the world's longest running fathers-oriented show in the world. And that has been as a result of the efforts of many, many people. Many hundreds of hours have gone into, voluntary hours have gone into making the show what it is today. For those of us joining from live streaming around the world, thank you so much. You can listen to us via live streaming at 893fm.com.au. Don't forget, and also if you want to listen to the show later, don't forget our new website, www.dadsontheair.net. Now, there's been a number of interesting items from around the world. Protest at Royal Parade prevented. This is from BBC. Campaigners failed to stage a stunt in front of the Queen when 9 arrests were made before the Trooping of Colour. The Fathers for Justice group had planned to handcuff a member to the monarch's carriage at her annual birthday parade. But police said they made the arrests before the event began and released the group without charge once it was over. A police statement said the arrests took place prior to any principal's passing and were due to vigilant, robust and decisive police action. He said the arrests were made to prevent a breach of the peace as part of a large proactive policing operation. A spokesman for Fathers for Justice said they had other demonstrations planned. He added they had previously engaged in dialogue, but it was now a war of attrition. Because Fathers for Justice have done extraordinary things in highlighting the issue that affects separated fathers right around the Western world, including climbing Buckingham Palace, entering the British Parliament, and a number of other stunts.
Yes, we all remember the Batman stunt, Batman on Buck Powell there.
It's highly unlikely that these events, I think, would occur in Australia. Australians aren't quite so demonstrative, but the founder of F4J, Matt O'Connor, is a public relations guru before he became involved in fathers' issues, and he's done an absolutely astonishing job in raising attention to this issue. Another story you may have seen on television, the actor David Hasselhoff looking very drunk and stumbling, a really sad video of him. He's an alcoholic, or now a recovering alcoholic, and it was a very sad video. He got one of his teenage daughters to film him, perhaps because he knew that the consequence of that would be to shock him into sobriety. This is from a judge has granted actor David Hasselhoff custody of his two teenage daughters after a bitter court battle with his ex-wife that involved a video showing him drunk in the presence of one of the girls. He has primary, physical and sole custody, Hasselhoff's spokeswoman said. Hasselhoff, there must have been some problems with the mother as well, if that is the case.
They accused each other of taking drugs and carrying on, I think so, as I recall.
And he was stopped from seeing his kids, and it just shows you what the judiciary, how out of touch it is, because simply changing the custody from one dysfunctional parent to another doesn't solve the problem. It just changes the custody. That's all it does. Shared parenting would resolve most of it.
The research does indicate that if one parent is out of control and the other one is reasonably stable, that the kids often do quite well as long as they have one stable parent and as long as they get to see the other dysfunctional parent. Yes.
But is it being a stable parent getting your kid to video you when you're drunk?
Well, I don't know. We essentially here support shared parenting or joint custody, except in extreme circumstances. Hasselhoff, 54, is a former star of TV's Baywatch. I think we'd all remember that. Who's now a judge on a contest show, America's Got Talent, and he divorced his wife, Pamela Bark, 43, in August 2006. The two have battled over custody of the daughters, Taylor Ann, 17, and Haley, 14, ever since. The star beamed with delight as he emerged from a Los Angeles courtroom where the custody hearing took place, and the judge said, enough is enough. As you can imagine, there was no doubt a media circus around that one. Another really interesting story that's about, this has been on the lead story on CNN all week that I've seen. It's called Fathers at War. I'd urge you to look that up on the CNN site. Just do a Google on CNN. Fathers at War see children grow up in pictures. And it's got a picture of Williams, who's told his 6 and 8 year old sons he was fighting the bad guys and helping Iraqi kids. And they go, home has been reduced to a handful of photos, emails with the children, a homemade silver dog tag. When they can, the dads swap memories when no one is trying to kill them. Army Staff Sergeant Dustin Williams was supposed to be home on this day, Father's Day, it's just been Father's Day in America, to feel the embrace of his 4 young children, but he couldn't. Like so many fathers fighting in Iraq, the essence of home has been boiled down to the basics. Quote, I got get photos and videos in boxes and trinkets in boxes, says Williams. That lets me know they're there and they care. That's something I can hold on to. It's a piece of life from the other side of the world, about 8,000 miles away from Fort Lewis, Washington. Williams relaxes for a few moments between missions to talk about his children. He's based on the outskirts of the city of Baqabah, some 40 miles north of Baghdad, a new stronghold for the Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And what a mess it is in Iraq these days.
But John, you don't have to be in Iraq for that to happen. It can, a lot of fathers are only seeing the pictures of their children right on, they're only a block away from where they live, and that's the same sort of contact they have with them.
That's very true. Previously, prior to the current family law reforms, there's been some improvement, but prior to that, historically in Australia, 25% of the children entering the family court never saw their fathers again, and 50% of those children basically saw them once or twice a year. These are appalling outcomes. They were state-engineered and judicially-engineered outcomes. They've had an appalling social impact on this country. Williams said, you watch your children grow up in pictures. That's pretty much what I'm doing. And he flips through a small album of photographs. Another really amazing story, really, from the New South Wales Department of Community Services that has been playing in the papers this week. Peter?
Yes, you may remember, most people remember this, it was on the front page of the papers. A pastor found a newborn baby on the steps of his Western Sydney church. He took it into the authorities, and the baby's doing really well. Him and his wife has been going in to see the baby regularly, but now, in the wisdom of Doc's wisdom, they will have refused him access to the child.
That's an oxymoron, Peter, if ever I heard one. Doc's wisdom, that's a serious oxymoron.
Exactly. They consider that it's not in the baby's interest for her to become too attached to the baby. They want to take Joan out of Haberfield for a fresh start, so she's away from the media and all that hype. They don't. They won't allow contact with the family or Joan at all. He's only to contact the child via Docs. Now this man and his wife have got 3 other children.
Oh, and they look like a really, from the photographs, look like a really happy, well-adjusted family. He's a really proud dad, obviously. She looks like a really wonderful mum. And they want this kid to grow up without other children, as a single child. That's just absolute madness, surely.
Where are they coming from? Helen Freeland, executive director of Doc's Helpline, confirmed the ban on the Backinghams visiting Joan. Now, it would have to be a female, Helen Freeland. It's another example, perhaps, of where feminism has taken control of another department.
Well, I don't even know if this is feminism. It's insanity.
Yeah, it's bureaucracy gone mad.
It's terrible. There are numerous scandals within the Department of Community Services. Bob Carr, unfortunately, tried to solve the problem by just splashing hundreds of millions of more dollars into the Department of Community Services without fixing their practice. And their practice involves the use of highly suspect family report writers and psychiatrists, very secretive courts. The scandals that would emerge from this Department if the secrecy surrounding it and surrounding the Children's Court was lifted would be a serious, serious embarrassment to the government of the day. We're going to go to a song, and then after that we're going to do our section on new dads. Stay listening.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you groan. Except that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming. You sink like a storm, for the time they are changing. Come mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters beyond your command. Your own road is rapidly aging, so get out your new one. You can't lend a hand, for the times they are changing.
Program, we're going to look at the growing area of prenatal services for new dads-to-be. It wasn't so long ago that dads were almost entirely excluded from the birthing process. Tina Cassidy tells the story in her book called Birth, The Surprising History of How We Are Born. In 18th century England, women were not allowed to see their husbands for the month-long stay at a lying-in hospital. In Europe, men were rarely allowed into the birth chamber. As hospital births became common in the past century, men were removed even further from the process. They'd drop their wives off at the admissions desk and go back to work or back home to bed. Sometimes, with nowhere else to go, they hung around the hospital corridors for news. As hospital facilities expanded and modernized, expectant fathers could be found sitting on the edge of a seat in the Stork Club, specially designed waiting areas near the maternity ward where fathers could take off their jackets, fret, smoke, talk on a payphone, listen to the radio, and later watch TV. In 1961, the year before men were allowed into British delivery rooms, the British Medical Journal published a letter from a man saying fathers should have a right to remain for births, and that the pathetic, chain-smoking, restless, and flower-offering expectant father should be a figure of the past. Not everyone agreed. In America, hospital resistance to the idea was fierce well into the mid-1960s. In 1964, John Keim, a New Jersey father, was fined $150 for gaining unauthorized entry into the delivery room to see the birth of his second child. And John Quinn, a California college student, chained himself to his wife while she was in labor to protest against the hospital's ban on his being in the room. The police were called, and his story made the headlines. By the mid-70s, most hospitals had changed their policies and were permitting parents to stay together, with two exceptions: those who weren't married and those whose babies were born by cesarean. Today, of course, these exceptions have been lifted, and, at least in most Western hospitals, all fathers are welcome to attend the birth of their children. Just as many women fought for the right to work outside of the home, many dads have had to struggle for the right to be an equal parent alongside their children's mother. Although men often attend conventional prenatal sessions, much of the content is about the needs of the mother and the new baby, with men often attending out of duty to their partners, and often feeling that their role in the birthing and parenting areas is secondary. Feedback from men who've attended these sessions often say they neglected their greatest concerns, which are their changing identity, their relationships, and their future role as fathers. The idea that new dads might need services to prepare them for what is probably their most profound life-changing experience, becoming a dad, is relatively new, but thankfully is becoming more and more widespread, especially as a new generation of men challenges the restrictive role of the male breadwinner and demands to be hands-on fathers, intimately involved with the day-to-day tasks of parenting. Recent press coverage of men's prenatal programs includes the popular daytime Channel 9 program, The Catch-Up, which featured midwife and children's nurse Chris May, who works at the John Hunter Children's Hospital in Newcastle. Libby Gore asked him what he says to the guys in his program about the crucial 0 to 3 month age period. Chris said, "I think it's a time where things can fall apart, where people can say things that you never get forgiven for, where things can happen that can change the course of the kid's life and the relationship's life. So we talk about how to cope with the crying, how to cope with the women's festival, how to cope with the gatekeeping that goes on around getting access to your child, how to manage your leave so you can be there when you've got an opportunity to interact with your child." ABC Radio's The World Today recently covered Lucy Perry's program, Beer and Bubs, which takes prenatal classes into a more relaxing pub setting. She devised the program 2 years ago because she says too many dads felt sidelined during childbirth, with many telling her they were shocked by what they encountered because conventional classes didn't prepare them for it. While Perry's program is to be commended, some practitioners working in the area feel that, in order to be totally relevant for dads, prenatal classes for blokes have to be not only designed for new dads, they should also be run by dads. One such dad is Sean Tonnet, who runs the Transition to Fatherhood course at Manly Hospital in Sydney. I asked Sean how he came to be involved with running a prenatal program for new dads.
Well, my partner and I had our child in October last year, and at the time we went through a prenatal course with a local hospital. And I guess becoming a dad, I was really surprised at what it was like to be a dad, and very surprised about the changes that I went through in my lifestyle with my partner, and also, I guess, just becoming a dad and having a new boy in our lives. And the thing that's, I think, motivated me was that I realised that there wasn't education in the community for men, by men.
Right, so when you were expecting your little boy, what did you and your partner do in terms of antenatal services and programs? Did you go along to some stuff which concentrated more on the mother and the child and not much on the dad, or what did you go through with your partner?
Well, I guess because we were having our child at the hospital, at Manly Hospital, so we were booked in for the birth to be there, and as part of that they asked us to come and do their generic in-house prenatal class.
What did that consist of?
It's a six-week course.
Right, and so an hour, a couple of hours a week or something?
Yeah, every Tuesday night we went along, and it went from 7:30 till 9 o'clock. And I guess what I found was that, in hindsight, that lots of the education was about how a mother can be a great mother and how important that is.
Yep.
And I guess what a man can do to support his partner in playing that role.
Right. that's, I guess, the standard model of antenatal programs around Australia, I imagine, would be based around something like that.
I guess so, and certainly talking to other fathers who have been to other prenatal classes at different hospitals, then that's a very similar model, and certainly the feedback I get. And working with the dads, it's been wonderful to get the feedback that lots of the new dads and expecting fathers are very excited about getting that kind of information from a man about becoming a father.
All right, so why don't we talk a bit more about the program. So where have you run your program so far?
At Manly Hospital.
Okay, which is the same place where you through 6 months before
or something. Yeah, exactly.
And how did you introduce that to the hospital? Was there any resistance? Were they supportive?
Oh, they've been very supportive.
Yeah?
And very excited about it. And I just wrote to them and told them about my experiences and what I felt I could offer. And I guess having done the course, I also knew that there was one night out of the six-week course where the women go off to learn about breastfeeding and the men traditionally
have a beer or
a chat. Yeah, pretty much.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, so is the common question I get asked. It's like, you know, did you bring some beers with you? So I thought, well, I guess having some knowledge of the course, I knew that there was an opportunity to work with the men on a particular night. And they were really open to it, and the feedback I had from them was that they'd actually been looking for something like that and someone with the right, I guess, passion and experience and qualifications to come in and be part of it. So that's been great. And since then, it looks like I'll be working with Mona Vale Hospital as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the women are doing their breastfeeding thing and you sit with the blokes for the full hour and a half?
Yeah, about an hour.
Yeah.
So it varies from, you know, 45, 50 minutes to an hour 20.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what do you talk about with them? If it's not a trade secret.
Lots of stuff around what my experiences are of fatherhood. And so that's a big part of the course, making it quite personal and experiential.
Right.
And questions around how I've found it being a dad and going back to work and getting that balance right between what's obviously a financial commitment to having a family and also the desire to be at home, to be involved with the child.
Do you think that that's a bit of a worry or a dilemma for contemporary fathers, that they're, with the changing role models, I guess, there's a bit of confusion between that role of being the breadwinner and being out there and supporting the family financially, but also increasingly a desire to be very hands-on with their parenting, and that, in a sense, it almost takes a Superman to be able to do both.
Yeah.
Do you find that's common?
100%. And it's a struggle that I've had too. And I think that in a contemporary society, we're really encouraged to do, I guess, you know, inverted commas, active fathering, which is exactly what you've talked about, this idea of being more involved with our children and more at home and more able to participate in every part of their lives. And there's a lot of research that's gone into showing that the more that fathers are involved with their children, the more socially and emotionally and cognitively functional they're going to be in later life.
Do you find that any of the guys have difficulty sometimes negotiating with their partner? Because traditionally the rearing of kids has been seen as more of the mother's domain, and that some mothers can exhibit a little bit of gatekeeping, that they feel like their territory is being encroached upon when the dad wants to say, hey, can I come and help with those mothering, in inverted commas, duties? Do you find that that's an experience that any guys have?
Yeah, definitely. And I'd probably say in my own life as well. So sometimes I've really had to set a quite strong boundary and say, look, this is important to me. And what I need to do now is I feel like spending time with my son in this way, whatever that could be, is important for our relationship and also helps me to be a better dad. So I think one of the critical things is the more that men can get in there, and they may need to set a boundary with their partner and say, look, I really want to learn how to help settle the child or to feed the child or be able to take him out for a couple of hours or an afternoon or whatever. The more that fathers can do that, the more competent they're going to feel as dads.
Mm.
And the more able they're going to be able to give their partner time to relax and engage back in her normal life. But also it ties back into that kind of overall theme of this active fathering, where building that bond and relationship is going to be so beneficial for the child.
Mm.
But in relation to your question, what it takes is some sort of negotiation. And I think where men actually need to set a boundary and say, look, I need to have space and time to work this out in my way as a father.
Do you think that's difficult for a lot of guys? Sometimes they might accept that mother is the so-called expert on parenting because she's a female, and they sometimes defer to her rather than sort of standing up and saying, look, I really feel I need this for myself and for my relationship with my child.
Yeah, I think it's very hard, and I still find it hard too. And I know that, like, if our child's upset and he's had a couple of weeks where he's been a bit funny at night time, and I've really wanted to get out on some nights, I wouldn't say all nights, but get up and help to settle him. And it's actually quite distressing for my partner. If he's crying for too long, it really upsets her. And she will often just come in and say, look, I want to look after him. So we have to kind of negotiate that space. And obviously, if she's upset, then that might also upset the baby. So sometimes I just do defer. But sometimes I also need to say to her, look, this is really important for me. And for me, it seems to gives me a lot of courage and a lot of confidence to say, I'm okay with this. And most times the baby will settle, and I feel really good about doing that as well. Yeah. And it is hard. Yeah. It's a difficult space that each male and his partner will need to take steps, gentle and compassionate steps, towards negotiating and finding what works for both people.
When I dream at night, it's you I see walking. In that dream I hear you laughing and talking. When I'm all alone, it's you that I'm missing. When I think I've fun, it's you that I'm kissing. Shopping.
I'm talking with Sean Tonet from the Transition to Fatherhood program for new dads at Manly Hospital.
Do you think potentially there might be room to expand your program so that you actually do a course or an evening or part of an evening with both the mums and dads to balance things out? If a couple's going for a 6-week course and 5 of those weeks are about the mum and the baby, and one of those weeks is about the dad stuff, the dads have learnt for 5 weeks what the mum's going to go through. But at the moment, you haven't had a session to let the mums know what the dads are going to be going through. Do you think that there's room for developing that so that the mums get a sense that how it might feel for a new dad when they're in bed at night and mum goes to comfort the kid and the dad may feel powerless or really wanting to do something, and you know, those experiences that new dads go through, that to communicate them to the mums so that they know what their partners may go through as new dads?
Yeah, absolutely. It's in its infancy. And it's wonderful to hear ideas like that, because I think that there's a lot of scope for driving this program in all sorts of directions. And I think all power to what direction it goes in, because really the more the information is out there and the more that competent and passionate people are getting up to work with parents, men and women, the better it is for the children.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
I think new dads have a lot to offer other new dads. And I was very surprised. I would encourage people as well, new dads, to talk to expecting fathers who are friends of theirs about what it is like to become a father.
Right, even just in an informal chat,
absolutely.
Not necessarily as part of a formal program like your own, but just to have a chat and say,
absolutely.
Hey, mate, you know, you've got a new one coming along, and share some of your stories of what it's been like for you.
Absolutely. I mean, even the birth story. You know, like talking to my mates, lots of the information I got was how exciting and wonderful it is. And it is. It's fantastic. But I would have loved to have known a bit more about how things didn't go as expected in the birth, which happened for my partner and I. So
it probably happens more often than not.
Absolutely.
That things don't go according to plan.
Absolutely. And certainly there was no crisis, so we didn't have to go to an emergency cesarean or anything like that. But certainly there were times when it was stressful. And I didn't know I didn't kind of go in with enough information or enough internal resources or enough kind of understanding of what everyone might do in that situation, including like the paediatricians and the midwives, et cetera, to feel really able to just be there and be present for my partner.
Mm.
So it was very different to what I expected. So from that right through to the first few months of living with our baby and living with a new mother, the most I got from my mates was, oh, yeah, it's a great trip, you'll enjoy it. So I encourage men to go out there and let their friends know about what else is exciting and what else is different or surprising about becoming a dad.
Mm. And what were some of the things for you that you found?
Hard and different?
Well, yeah, yeah.
Mm. I think I've always lived my life quite spontaneously, so a really big one for me was how much more planning had to go into negotiating time that I might need either with my partner, with the family, or for myself. So that kind of idea of waking up on a Saturday morning to go away for the weekend
on a whim.
Yeah. Yeah, on a whim, exactly. That was gone.
Right. Mm. Do you find that a big change is feeling for a while like you might be playing second fiddle?
Yeah.
Sure. Baby's the first object of attention and you're now number two.
Yeah, sure. And I think that I felt, that was one thing I felt reasonably well I had understood about what mm-hmm. was going to happen. But what I do know and what I talk about in the course as well is that lots of men have come from an experience that may have been abusive, and this is a critical time when those kinds of issues can come up. Like, how am I going to be as a father when I never had a father that was a role model for me? So it can be a very anxious time for men. And I think that issues around how a father will be intimate with their new child is also something that's going to be critical around this time, because there could be concerns for men from their own fathering experience or experience of being fathered.
Mm. So do you think that some guys who experience some abuse or an absent father may feel that they may have worries that they may somehow perpetuate that when they become a father?
Sure, and even if it's not such a strong feeling as that's the way that they're going to be, it might be just because there was intimacy in a real loving family type intimacy, that was missing in their lives, how do they make that work in their lives now that they're becoming a father? You know, they may not be sure of the boundaries around contact and kissing and hugging and holding and gentleness, because they've never experienced
that themselves.
I can see that's not my experience, but I have worked with men and know enough about men who have had that experience that this is a time that can be very anxious for them. So I think that just knowing that is a big part of overcoming that hurdle. And what I encourage men in the course to do is to, I often say to them, look, the stuff we're talking about and the information I'm giving you, it'll probably turn to dust in the cupboard and you may never need this, but why I'm talking about this is giving you the awareness that for maybe 1 in 10 of you is a very loose statistic, some of this emotions and some of the themes that may cause some dysfunction in your lives may become prevalent, and now you've got some information in a booklet and lots of support to turn to. So we talk about what support mechanisms you can get in place for yourself, either within your relationship or externally of that.
So what are some of those mechanisms? Do you offer any sort of follow-up yourself, or do you do you give them a list of services they can contact, or how does that work?
Yeah, well, the information that I hand out on the day has a list of books and internet services and some non-government organisations that support men and families and parents and also children. And then I guess I talk a little bit about getting the support of family and friends around and how critical that can be. Two reasons for that. One, I think because it gives everyone a break, the primary carers a break, but what it also does is it allows a child to develop relationships with other people. So I think the sooner you kind of get mum and dad in there, in-laws or whatever, if they're available to learn how to be with your child and learn how to help settle the child and all the things that you're learning as a parent yourself, the better it is for the whole family.
Basically building that extended family network that seems to have disappeared in recent times.
Exactly what I was going to say, really. Yeah. And it's something that's just vanished from our community and culture. So the idea of, I guess, having to re-empower ourselves to make those connections again is really critical. So that's one part of it. The second part, I think, is judging what is workable within the relationship in terms of support, so between the mother and the father, if there's a crisis or an issue, and knowing when something that is happening within that family nucleus and dynamic, when you need to go for support externally of that. Because I guess it's very evident that any relationship is a dynamic, and what we bring in a co-created relationship between two people, and in this case a mother and a father, will have a border and will have areas that aren't safe to go into and areas that are very safe to go into. And that's quite normal and natural, and we do it in every relationship that we enter into. So I think that for men, knowing that if there's a crisis within that relationship, and it could be that it could be about the baby, and it could be the baby's not sleeping well and it's causing extra stress from the mum, or baby's not feeding well, or mum and or dad are dealing with some postpartum blues or postpartum depression, what's healthy within that relationship to deal with it, and when do you need to go outside of that to start looking for external support? And that's a very, very important thing.
It's probably a tricky thing to negotiate. I know there's been a fair amount of research that shows that part of the male archetype, in a sense, is to look after your problems yourself, be resourceful and independent, and fix your own stuff, and encouraging men to actually ask for help when they're used to being so independent and resourceful and solving things themselves is an important thing for men to learn. Because, you know, we're all human, and there are a lot of things that we do need external help for, and knowing when to ask for that help and not being ashamed to ask for help as a man. It may be a big step for guys to take that. Maybe the first time they've actually rang someone to ask for help because they're so used to solving things on their own.
Yeah, it's a massive step. And for me, in terms of my own journey over the last 10 years or so, I can completely relate with that. But what I can say from my own experience is how beneficial it's been to actually seek support, and that's eventuated in wanting to undertake and learn more about actually being able to give support to other men. And what I've found from that is that I'm a stronger man, and actually entering into that process took a lot of courage. So I tapped into that part of me that needed courage and strength and fire and passion, and all of those things were actually prevalent in undertaking that journey. So I hope that men who aren't sure about whether they need that support can really tap into their masculinity
to actually and take it on as like an exciting challenge for themselves.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And I have this idea around how for men, one of our frontiers was, you know, as hunter-gatherers, was going out and getting the food. And certainly in the last, you know, 30 or 40 years, it's been going out to get money. And certainly women are equaling us in that way as well. And I think one way that men can still find that edge in their masculinity is finding themselves. And that is the new edge for, I think, in some ways for men. That's where there's a real opportunity to be alive and to be excited and to find courage and strength and wisdom and the warrior inside by actually learning more about themselves. And in hindsight, that will make them better men and better lovers, better partners and better fathers.
Fantastic. Sean, thank you so much for the chat today.
Thanks, Greg.
Single man, but I haven't always lived up here along with all these other single men with a ring around the bar and a cigarette but in my beer. And I haven't always been a lonely man, and I haven't always lived alone. No, I haven't always drunk this much, but hey, before you cut me down, just try standing in my shoes, 'cause I don't have to hear one word out this mouth. The other day, I care what you say, but every Saturday is Father's Day. You might call it sad, you might call me mad, but I've got calls me dad. And all the other blokes that live up here know how to leave a man alone. And not a bad old bunch that live up here, but you know that it's not family and it's not home. While of a darling wife but once I had, well, I'm pleased to say that she still talks to me. I try not to think of what went wrong, 'cause if I said that I was right, she might say that she was right, and the only rights I care about are visiting rights. Day. I care what you say, but every Saturday is Father's Day. You might call it sad, you might call me mad, but I've got one who calls me dad. We go where he wants to go, we do what he wants to do. Tell him everything I know, 'cause I'd do anything to prove, yeah, I'd do anything to prove. And every Saturday I will do just what he says, 'cause each and every Saturday is Father's Day. You might call it sad, you might call me mad, but it don't feel so bad me. You might call it sad, you might call me mad, but it don't feel half bad when he calls me. You might call it sad, you might call me mad, but God, I feel so bad when he calls me dad. Yeah.
ever been a single man. We're back with Dad's on the Air.
Joel Edson is a fourth-year occupational therapy student who's developed the Fathers and Families Project in Port Augusta in rural South Australia. I asked Joel what existing services were available for new dads in Port Augusta before his project came along.
Well, basically there was absolutely none that was specifically tailored for dads. There was the existing service that was the norm that you'd see across Australia, the existing mm-hmm. antenatal focusing on the birth and the sort of medical, biomedical side of things.
And so dads would be involved in that, but the focus was on the mum and the child? Is
almost
that
the idea? Entirely on the birth process, the mum, you know, being pregnant and the actual delivery. There was no content that I could find that talked about either separating mothers and fathers' roles or even talking about parental roles at all.
So there was really no discussion of parenting skills or education or advice. It was all about the medical side of the birth,
yep,
pretty much.
Almost entirely. And
do you think because the focus is on the medical side of things, it's about their partner or their wife giving birth?
Exactly.
Then how's it relevant for me as a bloke?
Exactly.
Is that the idea?
Exactly. Mm. And I think when you're talking about antenatal education in terms of the biomedical stuff, that is really important. And, you know, in doing my project, I really, you know, my intention was not at all to devalue what they were doing, but I think it does sort of reflect a lot on, you know, the content of the existing programs when you've got blokes who are sitting there going, well, what the bloody hell am I doing here?
Right, you know, I don't really want to be here. How's this relevant?
I don't really want to be here. Mm-hmm. You're not telling me anything that's going to help me. Most of the stuff you're telling me is freaking me out. And I'm
making me worry about the health of my partner or
my
whatever.
My partner, yeah. My child. And a lot of blokes often feel that, like they feel like they're, you know, they're lacking something because they don't feel any of the, you know, for a woman, they're going through a lot of physical changes and, you know, they can feel things happening to them.
Mm.
Whereas a bloke can watch his partner going through that. They can't feel it. And so they often feel like they're on the outer and, you know, what the bloody hell can I do here? You know, should I be feeling this? Should I be feeling that? You know, and so they feel inadequate in what they're doing because they don't feel like they understand their role in it all. And because it's not addressed, a lot of these blokes, you know, they were really cautious about what they could say about their partner being pregnant and that sort of thing because they just didn't understand where they fit into the big picture of pregnancy.
So when guys sort of say, oh, my missus dragged me along and don't really want to be here, it's not that they don't want to be there because they couldn't really give a stuff about the birth order. It's because they desperately want to be involved in the process, but they don't really see how they can fit in. Is that your assessment?
That's exactly what I would draw from it, and I think that's why I acknowledge what the antenatal, you know, education process is aiming to do.
Mm.
It would upset me to think that the people providing this antenatal education feel that they are servicing men and men's needs. If they think that they are, then that's a real concern, I think.
Mm.
Because, like you say, it's not that the blokes aren't interested. It's not that they don't care. It's not that they don't, you know, want to know about these things and, you know, try and manage the foreseeable outcomes of the pregnancy and that sort of thing. But when they're in a situation where they're going, shit, I don't really feel like I can do anything here. And it's more their insecurity about being in that environment. They want to be involved. They want more from it. They want to be really engaged with it. Like, they just don't feel that they can be.
Mm. And you think that it's the case that no one's actively excluded blokes. It's just it probably hasn't crossed their mind.
Exactly.
And to actually just to put it on the agenda may go a long way.
I think because
they actually may think, in the future when they're planning things, just that little thought in the back of their mind that,
exactly,
how can we make this a little bit more relevant?
And a lot of the stuff that Richard Fletcher's been doing in the Father Inclusive Practice frameworks and that sort of thing, the reason I've been so impressed with his work is because of the simplicity of it. You know, it's not like the suggestions that he makes or that they make in the people who are involved in Father Inclusive Practice stuff. It's not like they're making these big statements about, you know, you've got to knock down all the health facilities and rebuild ones that are like this so blokes can feel comfortable in them, or that fathers can feel more included. It's really, really simple things like health services. It is so common, and in my discussions with a lot of the health services in Port Augusta, a lot of them are saying, what I mentioned to them was, when you ring up to make an appointment for a child health visit, so, you know, kids 0 to 5 years, when you make an appointment, who do you speak to? And they're like, oh, the kid's mum. And I was like, well, what about the dad? Do you speak to the dad? And they're like, no, we don't really speak to the dads. From their perspective, they weren't actively seeking to speak to the dad about it, but they weren't seeking to exclude the dad.
No.
And then often you have a bloke who will answer the phone and they'll say, oh, we want to make an appointment about your child. And they'll go, oh, I'll get my wife for you. I'll get their mum for you.
Mm.
And so making such a simple change as saying, oh, no, well, hang on, mate, you might be able to help me.
Right.
And simple things like that. And if you
can very small things.
If you can put those simple things in people's minds and get them to think about them, they can go to, you know, make a huge difference for blokes and their engagement with their kids and their engagement with services.
Mm. So that sort of begs the question, what the Fathers and Families Project that you've put together, can you give our listeners a brief rundown of the sort of programs that you've designed for getting blokes involved in these antenatal sessions?
One of the big things that I thought about in terms of developing this project was the fact that I didn't want it to just be suitable for the non-Indigenous, health service-seeking people living in Port Augusta. You know, in the region that is now covered by Country Health SA up there, you're talking people from all different backgrounds. Their lives are all totally different. You know, you've got people who are living in Port Augusta who live a fairly normal, or what you say, normal life, you know, 9 to 5, you know, weekends off, and then there's everything in between that, up to the people who are living there, and then doing 4 days, 4 on, 4 off at Roxby. I know at one of the gold mines, I think they do 2 weeks on, 1 week off, and so there's all sorts of different, you know, impacts on people in their lives, and so, you know, how can we access these blokes who are, you know, from all these different areas and all these different things happening in their lives? And so I thought, right, well, we've got to think about how we can provide options that can get to any bloke. Now, I don't know the stats on this, but I could pretty much guarantee that almost every woman who is pregnant goes to an antenatal visit or has someone come to visit them. So that's your access point. If the bloke's there, great. And if you can spend 2 minutes saying, good on you, mate, congratulations, here's a bit of stuff to think about, that's better than nothing. And so the first option is basically just saying, look, if you have this opportunity, take it. If you don't have the time to talk about stuff, give him this, you know. And so in their, one of their appendices, there's a letter that just basically says, you know, this is an awesome time, you know, be excited about it. You know, this is, things are going to change and it's probably going to be a challenge, but it's going to be great too. And, you know, think about the roles that you want to have and have with your family, and think about, one of the other things that is in the session plans is talking about attachment and building a relationship with your baby and looking at things like, you know, rather than saying, oh shit, well, I've got to change the nappy and, you know, bathe the baby, you go, right, this is my one-on-one time with my child. You know, one of the best times I spend with my baby daughter is bathing her and changing her. When you're changing her, she's right there looking at you, you know, and there's nothing else in her visual field. You're touching her, and that's, to me, is an awesome time. So I don't look at it as, bloody hell, I've got to change another nappy. You look at it as, you know, this is my daddy-daughter time. And so having that sort of outlook on things can be really beneficial in a number of ways. One, you're building a relationship with your baby and thinking about the fact that you're building a relationship with your baby. And two, from, you know, your partner's perspective, you're also supporting and helping. So I think that just sort of, it's just a different way of thinking that is so simple, yet it can really impact on the way you see those tasks. But yeah, and so basically the first option was just give him a bit of info, get him to think about it. So even if the bloke's not at the antenatal visit, give it to their partner, get them to take it home. At least you're trying to engage them in some way there. The next option that I put together was relying on existing antenatal education. So, for example, in the Port Augusta area, at the Port Augusta Hospital, they have a 5-week antenatal session. So you go for one night a week for an hour and a half. And I went and spoke to the community midwives who ran those sessions, and I was quite lucky that they sort of grabbed hold of this idea and went, yeah, this is great, we'd love to have this included in our program.
Mm-hmm.
In other places you might get some reluctance, but I was lucky in that way. And so basically I hijacked the blokes for an hour and a half.
Okay, so their partners were doing another session with the midwives,
with the
and
midwives.
You took them into another
That's
room.
Right, and one of the things that you'll do is you basically just have a list of prompting questions. And that's more so if things aren't going, you know...
You've had five minutes of silence.
I was going to say, if the blokes just aren't talking, which will often happen. But yeah, it is more. It's more about, you know, you can sort of set the seed. So you might... one of the things that I talked about in the sessions was, you know, roles and what you expect of, you know, what does the fatherhood role mean to you? And so you can have very open sort of questions that, you know, it will just sort of get their minds thinking. But then, yeah, what you want them to do is to explore those thoughts with themselves and with each other.
Mm.
So it is sort of structured in that you do try and want to get some content, you know, particular content covered, but you want the blokes to explore it themselves, because you're not teaching and preaching to them. You know, you're not bashing them about, you have to do this, you should do this, or expectations. It's about an exploration of what it does mean to them, because what fatherhood means to me is going to be different to what fatherhood means to you, and to what my partner expects fatherhood to be, you know, and people have different things. And so just to explore that and to think about that tends to make you feel, and see, this is from my personal experience, it just makes you feel more comfortable in the things that you're doing, and you're not constantly asking the question of yourself, oh, well, shit, you know, should I be doing that? You know, what would these people think if they were doing that? No, that's not what it's about. It's about me taking the role that I need to take with my kids and the role that I want to have as a father with my kids.
Mm. Is there a more advanced program that you would see as an ideal program?
One of the suggestions I've made for future would be to have three antenatal sessions, which are run completely separate to the existing antenatal stuff. And so basically just more time, so you can explore more issues. And then hopefully, because you're spending more time together, building more relationships with other blokes who are in the same situation, so you're all about to be dads, and you're probably shitting yourself about becoming dads, and... And there's nothing better than sitting around with another bunch of blokes talking about all the things you're shitting yourself about and finding out that they're all shitting themselves too. And
right.
So it's, you know...
And so you may build peer support networks there that maybe could support each other if they're having problems.
Into fatherhood. And then, I mean, beyond that, like some of the work that Dave Hughes is doing is following it on into the postnatal period. So once your child has been born, then having sessions, you know, in the first 6 months after the baby's born and sort of getting together and... You know, then it's an opportunity to reflect on your experience antenatal and the birth, and it is again that peer support, and you know, building networks with people, and it's I think one of the big things is, you know, normalising issues. You know, a lot of parents experience the same problems, and a lot of dads experience the same problems and issues and concerns.
But they're more than likely going to feel like they're the only one going through it.
Exactly, and you do, and I mean, Like, I preach all this stuff, but for myself, a lot of this stuff, you know, when I think about myself, I think, wow, you know, that would have been great for me to... I wish I'd had that, you know, when I was going to be a dad. I can remember going to the antenatal sessions and you just feel like... I can't remember, it was a term in someone's paper, that you feel like you're a pimple on the elephant's ass, and you're sort of coming in and you're just that annoying thing that gets dragged along and sort of sits there on the outer. And I mean, I did value a lot of the information about the birth and that sort of stuff, but it didn't, you know, it prepares you for that moment, which is a really insignificant amount of time, really. Even if you have a 20-hour labour, you've then got the rest of your life as a parent.
Mm.
From that moment on, you are a parent until you die, you know, and so that's really huge, and it's just not covered. And so I think I would have found it really valuable to have more, you know, time spent on looking at the early parenting period, and I think other people will value it too.
Joel Edson, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Good luck with the project and with whatever work you end up doing in the future.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Greg. It's been great.
Cheers.
Besides the good work being done by Joel Edson, Sean Tonet, Chris May and Lucy Perry,
There are a number of other people running prenatal courses for new dads-to-be around Australia. Steve Shee runs the excellent Fatherhood Support Program at the Women's and Children's Hospital and the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Adelaide. Dave Hughes runs the Building Better Dads program out of the North Coast Area Health Service in Bangalore. Mark Friederwald has created the highly commended Father Time, Welcome to the Rest of Your Life sessions, which now run at all prenatal classes on the central coast of New South Wales. Tony White runs the I'm a Dad program in Coffs Harbour. Evan Webster is the coordinator of Hey Dad in Western Australia and has been offering services at Osborne Park Hospital for 7 years and at King Edward Memorial Hospital for almost as long as that. Rob Koch at the City of Casey in Victoria runs pit stop courses for new dads and is working towards implementing prenatal sessions as well. And the Good Beginnings Australia program called Dads Connect is now part of all prenatal services in Tasmania and is also run out of hospitals in Victoria and New South Wales. We'll put the details of these programs as well as contact details for Sean and Joel on our website at dadsontheair.net. If you know any guys who are about to have a new baby or you're about to become a dad yourself, go to your local hospital and ask whether they offer prenatal classes for men. This has been Greg Andreessen reporting for Dads on the Air.
I'm here to tell you about the evils of drink. Now drink can turn a loving woman into a nagging wife. That means there's only one thing left to do. Give up the grog. Or give up the missus. Or you might find yourself saying,
I gotta give the grog away. I gotta give the grog away. But I'd rather get rid of that nagging tart. She's cruel to me drinking, it's breaking me heart. I gotta give the grog away. Oh, you know it's a terrible state of affairs when a man can't have a quiet social drink at 6 in the morning. I woke up this morning, the missus said you were drunk last night. I said I was not. I was socially excited. She said you were drunk. It took you over half an hour to get your underpants off. I said, well, that doesn't mean I was drunk. She said, what? Over your head. And she turned nasty and said, you better give the grog away. You better give the grog away. Oh, you better stop drinking that filthy grog or you'll be sharing the kennel with the family dog. You better get the grog away. But there's troubles I've had this week. There I was going through town doing 110 mile an hour. I went through 14 stoplights, hit 2 zebras on the zebra crossing. Went round the corner, went right up the back end of a cop car. Copper got out the car in the pouring rain and bit of blood hanging off his forehead. I looked across at him and straight away I thought to myself, good, he's upset. Funny how you can tell, isn't it, eh? He came straight over, he said, you stupid motorist. He said, didn't you see me? Oh, I said, I hit you, didn't I? He said, well, you're a silly boy. I said, well, I'm not getting wet. He said, don't you get smart with me. He said, you're going to do your licence for this. Well, I had to have a bit of a chuckle to myself. Haven't got one. Then he turned nasty and said, you better give the grog away. You better give the grog away. You better stop driving on Port 05. You'll wake up in the morning, you won't be alive. You better give the grog away. I'd better stop drinking that filthy grog, or tonight I'm sleeping with the family dog. I got to give the grog away. But I'd rather get rid of that nagging tart. She's cruel to me drinking, it's breaking me heart. I got to give the grog away. I just won't give the grog away. Now why should I give the grog away? He just won't give. Come on, move over you got fleas, but you don't answer back. Crack us another tinny, mate. Come on, have a little bit of the old brown liquid in your doggy bowl, Rover. There's a boy. Come on, cuddle up, son. Why should he give? Not so fast, Rover. Only got half a dozen tinnies left. Well, it's quite cosy in here, really. Can get the telly in and we could make a bit of a feature wall up the back there. Come on, cuddle up, son, me and you'll be right. Hats a boy. I don't know why I didn't think of this earlier.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
Prue Goward is the former Australian Federal Government Sex Discrimination Commissioner. She is an anachronism from the late 20th century when the feminist juggernaut all but blotted out the son in favour of the daughter. As far as she is concerned, there is only one type of sexual discrimination in this world, and that is against women. She was and continues to be utterly sexist, incapable of recognising that men can also be victims of anything. Bucking the usual trend that sees talented politicians moving from state to federal government, Prue went from the federal government to the state government and is now the New South Wales Liberal member for Goulburn. Instead of being a national embarrassment, she is now the exclusive inconvenience of New South Wales. Her pre-selection for the seat was one of the most blatant public acts of sexual discrimination this state has ever seen. After a failed attempt to gain pre-selection for the seat of Epping, as she sobbed hysterically in the car park, the then leader of the New South Wales Liberal Party, Peter Debnam, was heard to remark, "I'm going to get Prue into a seat. We have to do it." Now, why did he feel that he had to do this? Was he discriminating in favour of her because of her amazing talents? I don't think so. He felt he had to find her a seat because of her sex and her privileged position. Eventually elected by a margin of less than 1,000 votes in what had previously been considered a safe Liberal seat, Prue then demonstrated her complete unsuitability for the privilege by indulging in a taxpayer-funded junket to Dubai. And as if that wasn't enough, she was then caught speeding through a school zone in her electorate. Simon Benson and Bruce McDougall wrote this in the Daily Telegraph on the 19th of May, and I quote, "Star Liberal MP Prue Goward has been fined for a second driving offence in less than 3 months, this time for speeding through a school zone during the peak morning period. The increasingly trouble-prone former Federal Sex Discrimination Commissioner was caught in a police blitz outside Marulan High School in her electorate of Goulburn. She was travelling at up to 15 kilometres over the limit. In February, the MP, touted as a potential future leader of the Liberal Party, was fined for going through a stop sign. It was not clear whether children were crossing the road when Miss Goward was stopped at 8:40 a.m, but the students are not required in class at Marulan Public School until 8:55 a.m. Ms. Goward, whose rocky start to her political career includes embarrassment over a taxpayer-funded trip to Dubai and controversial allegations that New South Wales Parliament was a chauvinistic bear pit, escaped the loss of further demerit point and an increased fine of $128 under new laws on school zones, which came into force on Monday. After being suitably chastised by her party leader, Barry O'Farrell, Ms. Goward told the Saturday Daily Telegraph that she was running late. "I am very cross with myself," she said. "I was late. It was raining. I was distracted. It's been a big lesson for me." Which, unquote, I think the implication that she could learn anything is going a bit far. Her first day in Parliament saw her strutting into the bear pit, a creature of privilege with her $12,000 Hermes handbag, where she ignored the debate on climate change that was taking place, despite supposedly being opposition spokesperson for the environment, and launched into an attack on MP Sandra Norrie for not pursuing allegations of domestic violence against MP Paul Gibson. "Just so you don't think that I'm making all this up, I'm going to read part of an article written by Simon Benson that appeared in the Daily Telegraph on the 31st of May. I quote, "The new MP opposition spokeswoman for the environment rose to ask her first question in Parliament, but surprised MPs when she directed it to Premier Morris Yemma over the investigation into alleged domestic violence against former sports minister Sandra Norrie. She asked why Mr. Yemma would not force Labor MP Linda Voltz, a former staff member of Miss Norrie's, to give evidence to the police investigation. Mr. Gibson, who was sitting opposite Miss Goward in the Legislative Assembly, winked at Miss Goward as she got up to leave the chamber immediately after her question. She was derided by other male Labor MPs to cries of, 'What? She's clocked off already?' Ms. Goward called a press conference while a debate in the House on climate change, her portfolio, was still going on. She widened her attack on what she claimed was a Labor government that appeared to condone domestic violence. After condemning Ms. Volt, Ms. Goward turned on the alleged victim, Ms. Norrie, for allegedly refusing to give a written statement to police to the alleged crimes committed against her. She is uncomfortable giving evidence, we all understand that, but she is also being intimidated by a Labour Party culture that does not want her to give evidence against one of its favourite sons, Ms. Goward said. What other reason is there? When informed of Ms. Goward's claims in Parliament by the Daily Telegraph, a shocked Ms. Norrie said, "You are kidding." But wait, there's more. Not content with attacking the women in Parliament for not attacking the men, she accused the entire House of being sexist. Rachel Brown wrote this in the Sun Herald on the 27th of May. New South Wales Premier Morris Yemma has lashed out at opposition frontbencher Prue Goward over her comments about sexism in state parliament. Ms. Goward said women were subjected to comments about their personal appearances and private lives. She said women working in parliament were forced to wear trousers to avoid their legs being scrutinised by their male colleagues. And I quote Ms. Goward here, she said, "I have never worked in any profession as male-dominated or as ruthlessly sexist as this. I was quite shocked by it. Politics, and particularly that parliament, is particularly male-dominated and extraordinarily chauvinistic in a very primitive physical way that I don't expect people to still behave." The Premier rejected the accusation, saying Miss Goward was a political novice. "I think perhaps Miss Goward ought to put her head down and focus on the job of being a member for Goulburn," he said. When Prue Goward tosses a coin, it always comes up Prue Goward. There's only one face on her coin. She remains a one-eyed, one-trick pony, a hypocrite, incapable of offering anything positive to 50% of her constituents simply because, through no fault of their own, they happen to be men. Gentlemen, I think it's fair to say that with Prue Goward in Parliament, New South Wales is definitely in the Prue.
Cause I
You might remember the well-publicised case of Liam McGill, who found that he was paying child support for children that were not biologically his own. The Victorian courts awarded him compensation, but in all their wisdom, the taxpayer-funded women's groups took him to as far as the High Court, where he lost. It was a very long and excruciating and emotionally tormenting case for all those involved. This we have here is the very last letter that the Child Support Agency will receive from Liam McGill. He sent us a copy of it. It's an open letter. It's written to Matt Miller, the General Manager of the Child Support Agency, and he writes, "Dear Mr. Miller, I have received your last letter because Mr. Miller offered to meet with him, and I have no desire to meet with you or anyone from the Child Support Agency, and I want at the outset to ask that you refrain from writing to me ever again on medical grounds. Once upon a time, I was a hard-working public servant like you, intent on building a life like any Australian citizen. My service to the Australian public spanned 35 years. My life was destroyed in a few short years by simply marrying and become an apparently legal, though not biological, parent to children fathered by another man during my short 4-year marriage to Meredith McClellan McGill. Your offers systematically destroyed my role as a father to children I thought were mine by stripping every asset away and destroying my health and my capacity to work. This is by no means a unique experience, I can assure you. He goes on, I hope one day these children who are supposed to be your first responsibility will come to realise what happened in their convoluted and much publicised lives when their mother chose to mate with a man named Derek Rowe, as well as me, her then legal spouse, and produce a somewhat curdled family, and then went ahead to try and hide the facts from everyone. I am now a ward of the taxpayer, and apparently he's absolutely devastated and in very poor physical health.
A broken man.
Yeah. Absolutely broken.
Yep.
He says, I am now, understandably, I am now a ward of the taxpayer, and in respect to the statement of financial services that you so callously forwarded to me, because of course costs were found against him, I no longer need to continue to tell you or anyone else that I am financially and emotionally wrecked. All evidence of my assets and income are known and reviewed constantly by the Department of Social Security, and with your powers, you do not need my permission to access any documentary evidence of my capacity to pay anything to anyone. I think it was hundreds of thousands of dollars in court costs he was ordered to pay. And, you know, of course, he just has absolutely no ability to pay. His last asset, which was an old car, was vandalised and burnt outside his house one night. Great. Yeah, the final act of revenge. It's all on government file, he writes, and there are no hidden agendas whatsoever. I fail to see why you use the term mutually satisfactory arrangement in your letter, because this is a matter that should have been quickly resolved by withdrawing the cost order and avoid causing the Australian taxpayer to throw more good money after bad money brought about by incompetent and biased child support agency administrative decisions. The Commonwealth, at great cost to the taxpayer, has avoided reimbursing me for an overpayment of child support, and he calls it paternity tax, which it most certainly is, by mounting a high-powered and costly defence of my claim in the Victorian County Court. This aggressive defence was to ensure that a legal precedent was not established. The cost of that refund of child support now has paled in comparison to what was due and refundable to me in 2000. The result has been to pour tens of thousands of dollars down the drain to allow officers of the Child Support Agency to retain and justify the very bad discriminatory decision made after the DNA test results. The county court final result falsely and misleadingly professes to have been a win, quote-unquote, for the Child Support Agency. It most certainly has not been a win for the families or children who will continue to suffer from what has been described as DDD, Dad Deficit Disorder, and this will never be solved by prescribing medication or continually disadvantaging fathers. Where is there, or was there, the remotest possibility that the taxpayer could stand to recover costs such as these legal costs you are pursuing, even though to this day I have yet to even cite any such account? Well, you can bet in the High Court, with barristers flying everywhere, it would amount to hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, all of which some poor bastard in a factory somewhere, probably in these suburbs, has helped to pay for.
I think Hitler had a department like that, didn't he? Called the Gestapo?
My advisers inform me that they have invited the Child Support Agency to avoid making a claim and cut their losses as a mutually satisfactory outcome, and certainly that would appear to be the most fiscally responsible action under the circumstances. Legal and accurately calculated evidence exists that I have substantially overpaid my child support, paternity tax, and your file notes are littered with evidence of who should have been levied for at least two of the children. Yet your office documented in their own internal correspondence that it was problematic to pursue the other biological father, Derek Rowe, who has since successfully transferred many hundreds of thousands of dollars into his wife, Veronica Rowe's name, including his personal assets and property. Most of my colleagues are bewildered as to why an agency as powerful as yours could find this due debt to the Commonwealth and to the children of the curdled family so problematic. I guess only those members of your staff and case officers will ever be able to fully explain this to me and to the media outlets who are waiting patiently to fully report on this debacle. Please consider this reply, which will be the very last communication with you or any members of your staff from your office. A copy of this letter is being forwarded to the senior executive lawyer from the Australian Government Solicitors, who of course pursued the case through to the High Court or assisted in doing so. Just getting these words down and visualising them has caused a considerable setback in my psychological well-being and can easily be seen to fit into the class of post-traumatic stress disorder. Anyone who deals with separated father issues will soon notice that many of them do portray the characteristics of post-traumatic stress disorder. They stutter, they're obsessive, they repeat things. He concludes, I am approaching 60 years of age and I now just want to live out my days free from the stranglehold of the Child Support Agency. It's signed by Liam McGill. His wife, Cheryl King, was written an open letter to all parliamentarians at Parliament House in Canberra, and she says, I urge all parliamentarians, this was released publicly this week, I urge all parliamentarians to put pressure on the Howard government to make DNA testing automatic at the birth of every child, when the mother is permitted to name the father without DNA testing and the presumption or the naming is in error, the results have far-reaching and disastrous consequences. The tragedy of false paternity tests falls first and foremost on children. Not only do children learn that the man they thought was their biological father is not, but they also learn that their mother lied to them and had sex with a man other than the one they believed was their biological father. This information can be devastating to a child. The tragedy of false paternity has an enormous impact on the deceived parties. The child and the father have been lied to by the mother. The consequences are emotionally destroying, with children also being denied knowledge, their medical history, bloodline, heritage, and personal identity. And certainly the lack of your genetic, with so much genetic medicine now, the lack of your medical history is very significant. There's been cases of children who have died as a result of a misinterpretation of a medical history. She refers to two websites which you can look up further information on paternity fraud. One is an American website, www.paternityfraud.com, and there is an Australian version of that website, www.paternityfraudaustralia.com.au, and she refers to the work of Mr. Carnell Smith from the USA, who is trying to get out to Australia to speak about these issues. Next week we have Graham Cohen. He's the author of a new book, Back from the Brink, Australians Tell Their Stories of Overcoming Depressions. It's an absolutely brilliant book. It features fascinating interviews with Australia's leading poet, Les Murray, and a very, very beautiful poet he is, and one of our foremost painters, the redoubtable Margaret Olley. She's a wonderful character, absolutely wonderful character, Margaret Olley. She's well known around Sydney for trundling around on a walking stick. I think she's about 89 or 90 now, and she's an absolutely marvellous character. She's a recovering alcoholic. She makes absolutely no bones about that. She'll tell anyone who wants to listen that there is a road to recovery from alcoholism, and she is an example of that. Her paintings too are also marvellous. If you want to listen to today's show again, it will be up at www.dadsontheair.net later today, and we'll be starting at 11 a.m. next week. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week.
We're Dads on the Air. We're here 'cause we care. We ask all the questions.